I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And this hour, Nicholas Kristof will be our guest. He has written a 5-column New York Times series on When Whites Just Don't Get It. August 30th was the first column, and the first sentence reads, "Many white Americans say they are fed up with the coverage of the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. A plurality of whites in a recent Pew survey said that the issue of race is getting more attention than it deserves." But Mr. Kristof believes the opposite, and he is pushing back at what he sees as smug white delusion. This is a continuing story, of course, and I'm sure that he wrote yesterday and has written 4 other, including yesterday, pieces on this issue, but he'll keep writing about this issue. And certainly the issue is very much with us, with demonstrations all over the country over Thanksgiving, and today with the announcement that the president is asking Congress for $263 million, in part to equip local police with body cameras. Mr. Kristof has, during the course of his series, reminded us of some statistics, and they are really, really alarming, that the black-white income gap is 40% greater today than it was in 1967. The net worth of the average black household is significantly less than in the white household. Black incarceration rate is so high. Wait till you hear the statistics on that. And there are gaps. There are all kinds of gaps, he says, and his columns are trying to take up this call, that the gaps demand a wrenching, soul-searching examination of our national soul. We need to acknowledge that the central race challenge in America today is not the suffering of whites. Nicholas is with us this hour of the program, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. He, let me tell you a little about his background. It's just been amazing. He's a Pulitzer Prize not once but twice winning columnist for the New York Times. Pieces appear twice a week. He grew up on a sheep and cherry farm in Oregon. He went to Harvard, studied law at Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship, studied Arabic in Cairo, Chinese in Taipei. He has lived on 4 continents, reported on 6, and traveled to more than 140 countries and all 50 states. He has a new book, A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity. It's co-written with his wife and is about making a difference here and abroad. For you to join our conversation with Nicholas Kristof, the number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And Twitter is at K Dunn Show. Nicholas Kristof, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good to join you.
Yeah, we're delighted to have you here. I'm as interested as I am in the statistics you give, and what you cover is just phenomenal. I'm also interested in the response you get to this issue, and I find it doing a talk show as well. When you look at issues of race, every time I do a show, I think, oh my gosh, we have so far to come. And you must feel the same after some of the letters you've received in response to what you've written.
Yeah. You know, I always think that in journalism, our real power is in shining a light on issues that are not illuminated and getting people to think about issues that they haven't thought about. But on issues that they have thought about, it is really hard to change minds. And indeed, race is something that people have thought, you know, a good deal about. And so I certainly have been getting an awful lot of pushback from a lot of white Americans who think that America spends much too much time talking about race, looking backward. It just creates excuses. And they think the principal problem is lack of personal responsibility. And, their line is more that, when New York Times columnists don't get it. So I've certainly been getting a lot of pushback.
Yeah. And yet you look at what has happened all over the country since the decision in Ferguson, and what's happened over Thanksgiving and this past weekend, you know, in Milwaukee at shopping malls, in New York, in Oregon, all over the country there have been demonstrations. It's obvious, so obvious to all of us, whatever color you are, that there is a big issue at play here.
Yeah, you know, it has been 50 years now since the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the great landmark legislation that was meant to, and that did indeed and have a huge impact. But it is kind of sad that 50 years later, we are still so divided, mm-hmm. that these issues are so raw, and that it's actually so hard to talk about these in a kind of adult way among ourselves.
Let's talk about some of the figures that you cited, particularly in the first column in this series. They're just appalling. The U.S. now has a greater wealth gap by race than South Africa did during apartheid. Isn't that something?
Yeah, it is. And I've been hearing from, you know, a number of indigent whites who say, well, that's a reflection of too many African Americans on welfare, family breakdown, and you know, there is an element of that. But one of the major reasons for this huge wealth gap between whites and blacks in America is housing policy. And the United States had a quite deliberate policy of subsidizing homeownership for whites, and this deliberately discriminated against African Americans and indeed promoted racial covenants in homes so that homes could not be sold mm-hmm. to blacks. And so this did indeed help create the middle class in America, but it created a largely white middle class. And it wasn't until relatively recently, past the middle of the century, the middle of the 20th century, that blacks increasingly began to access some of these tools. Like the GI Bill of Rights as well was essentially a way to usher white veterans into the middle class. So, you know, there are all kinds of issues here, and it's complicated. But I think we don't always appreciate the degree to which past discrimination mm-hmm. help shape the contours of inequality today.
Well, let's spend a little bit of time talking about slavery, and you write about slavery and post-slavery oppression, leaving a legacy of broken families, poverty, racism, hopelessness, internalized self-doubt. And you go on in another column to talk about the counties in America that had a higher proportion of slaves in 1860 are still more unequal today. It's a horrible legacy we have, and of course the effects of it are going to be long-lived, I would think.
Yeah, and this isn't just America. There, same studies have been done about areas in South America, for example, that had slavery, and those locales that did are likewise more unequal today. In the U.S., those counties that had more slaves in 1860 had more lynchings later on. They have more suspicion of affirmative action programs today. You know, that divide still, after all these years, has continuing effects today. And so, you know, I understand the calls of those who say, look, we have to look forward, not backward. But I think at the same time, we have to appreciate the degree to which the ground we are standing on has been shaped to an enormous degree by past discrimination. And, you know, if you're halfway through a race and you acknowledge that some people had a hugely unfair start, it seems to me that it's a little unfair just to say, oh, well, okay, you know, past head starts are irrelevant. Now it's a free competition.
Mm-hmm. You also, and I think this is still a huge issue, at least from the chair in which I sit, this issue of segregation, that our schools are still enormously segregated, our neighborhoods are segregated, and as you remind us, our friendship circles are quite segregated.
Yeah. Three-quarters of whites in America, according to one study, don't have a black friend. And I think that this kind of these informal networks are really how we become aware of the complexity of race or of anything else. You know, if one thinks about gay rights, I think it was really when gays began to come out and a lot of Americans suddenly realized that their friend or their brother or their cousin was gay, that that put a human face on it, and they became more accepting of gay rights. In the same way, when one study of judges found that judges who have daughters are more likely to support women's rights in the courtroom. And I think that if more whites had friends who were people of color and understood some of the ongoing challenges that they face because of that, I think that we might have a little more empathy and be more willing to address some of these issues.
Mm-hmm. You have heard from, I'm sure, more than one reader that the Vietnamese arrived in poverty in this country, and they're now the school valedictorians. That if you look at in the Hmong who have come here, that they're doing very well in terms of school. Why can't African Americans be like that?
Yeah, and indeed there are some immigrant groups that have done astoundingly well, and Asian Americans, especially those from East Asia, are indeed in that category. You know, there are also some real differences. Asian Americans tended to come with, and I, you know, my wife is Chinese American. They tended to come with a Confucian emphasis on education. They tended to come with this, you know, long emphasis on building education, on strong families. And that helped them tremendously. And in contrast, that has also been true to some degree of blacks from the West Indies and more recent immigrants from West Africa. That has been less true of African Americans who are inheritors of the burdens of slavery, who have been more likely to be locked in a cycle of poverty that becomes a poverty trap. And there's a long literature of poverty traps both abroad and at home. And it's once you're in that trap, it can be difficult to escape. And there are indeed some people who do, and, you know, more power to them. But I don't think that should rob us of our empathy and compassion for those who are stuck.
Yeah. And what has happened to that compassion? As you write, there are many people who put the blame on African Americans themselves, that they're not willing to work, that, you know, that they're absent from the family or they're leading lives of crime. There is a condemnation of a whole group of people, and I'm wondering how that came about. And why was
I don't hear think-
it?
Yeah, I don't think this is limited to race. In general, I think that we Cheryl and I just have a new book, A Path Appears, that is partly about how to create opportunity. And, you know, a lot of that is whites in working class areas who are likewise stuck in these poverty traps. And so often we hear this narrative that essentially blames the poor for their poverty, that sees it not as an economic failure, but as a moral failure on their part. Susan Fiske at Princeton did brain scans of people who are successful, looking at images of people who are poor or homeless. And she found that those successful people, when they were looking at these images, they processed them as if they were looking not at people, but at things. And so I think that we have a problem that is broader than race. It's a problem of people who have made it, who see a narrative of, you know, look, I studied hard, mm-hmm. I worked hard, I built a family, I had, you know, children only in the context of a marriage, and, you know, I never broke a law, I made it, you know, anybody can. And it strikes me that this is, you know, this is kind of people who were born on third base, congratulating themselves on hitting homers. And if, you know, so much of what I see of whether it's African Americans who are struggling or whites who are struggling, these are kids who at the very beginning don't have a great chance, don't have a leg up. And we fail them as a society before they fail us. We, you know, I mean, there's a this lovely four-year-old kid I met in West Virginia who had a hearing impairment. He had ear infections and wasn't taken to the doctor, and he became deaf, and this wasn't detected. And so he's now four, and he can't speak. Hmm. You know, how is that? You know, that child is facing a huge uphill struggle, and you can't say that it's the fault of that four-year-old. It's a larger societal fault that we didn't provide a hearing screening that could very cheaply have helped him out. And instead, you know, we tend not to invest in the front end. We tend to invest in the back end in prisons and juvenile detention centers and this kind of thing.
Yeah. And we also, when it comes to race, though, it seems as though, and this plays out again and again, and you cite a very well-respected African-American woman, I don't know who it is, whose son was out in front of their very nice house, and he was being stopped by the police, and she was just thankful because they thought he was an intruder. It was his house, for heaven's sake. That we have this perception that this is a group of people who are criminals, they're out to get us, we're afraid of them, they don't belong in a well-heeled neighborhood because you can't be well-heeled. I mean, the perceptions that you hear over and over and over again from African-Americans about how difficult it is to maneuver daily life just astound me still in 2014.
Yeah, and I think that is what we as whites tend to be kind of oblivious to, because, you know, because we don't see it, and it's very natural for everybody to notice their own problems and to be less aware of others. And I'm always kind of struck by how if you are African American, especially African American male, then it becomes you know that you have to save every receipt when you're walking out of a store.
Yes,
I had one friend who's enormously successful African American man, and he's married to a white woman, and they recently were purchasing something at a department store, and she bought it, and then she was crumpling up the receipt, and he was like, "Honey, how can you do that?" And she didn't understand, because of course nobody's going to accuse her of shoplifting, but he comes from a very different experience.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Nicholas Kristof. Many of you, I'm sure, read his column regularly. And you know that since August 30th, he's been writing a series, When Whites Just Don't Get It. And he laces the articles with facts about what it is that African Americans are facing in American society. He's looking at wealth gap, and he's looking at poverty and incarceration rates. We have yet to get to that issue, and schools, et cetera. We're welcoming phone calls for him. He's a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He writes his column for the New York Times twice a week about a real variety of just important issues all over the world. So we'll be to you momentarily. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nicholas Kristof is our guest this hour, and we're talking about his important series in the Times, When Whites Just Don't Get It. To your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Rick in Southwest Wisconsin is our first caller. Nicholas, hi, Rick.
Hi, Mr. Kristof. Thank you so very much. I wrote you a note after about the second of these telling you that you were right on the money, and I'm so happy to see you continuing. My question is this. You mentioned in one of the earlier segments that you got quite a bit of pushback from some white folks who didn't agree with you or didn't believe any of this was an issue. And I wanted to ask if you've had any dialogue with any of them back and forth, and how did it go? Were you able to open their mind or open their heart? Your thoughts on that dialogue. Thanks.
Sure. I'd say that there's been a certain amount of dialogue on my Facebook page, facebook.com/Kristof, and it's been kind of interesting. And I must say, reasonably civil, at least by internet standards, which maybe isn't setting that high a bar. but, you know, I don't I mean, there's been back and forth, and it has, at its best, been respectful. I don't know that either side is particularly convincing the other, though. I think that, and it may, of course, be that this is self-selecting, that people who tend to write are those who care the most about these issues and are least likely to be swayed. We all tend to have our own narratives in our minds, and I wish I could say I was changing minds, but, you know, there is one contingent that thinks, you know, it's obvious that we have deep racial bias in society, and another contingent that thinks it is obvious that we don't, and that we have an equal opportunity society, and, you know, this is all kind of a ploy to insult whites or hold them back, and that the real racial problem today is unequal opportunities for whites, which, you know, indeed is when you look at opinion surveys, white America believes that discrimination against whites is a greater problem than discrimination against blacks, and to me that seems just delusional, but it is very deeply felt among a lot of my correspondents. Mm.
Judy in Reedstown. Hi, Judy.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, Judy.
I can't hear you, but I'll say my piece anyway. I'm 73. I'm a little old white lady, and I'm not tired of the race inequality issue. And I don't think we speak enough about it and punished police violence against blacks. 50 years ago, I worked as a social worker on the south side of Chicago, and I witnessed provocation and police brutality. And when I heard about this killing in Ferguson, I thought to myself, nothing has changed.
Nicholas?
You know, I mean, I do think that things have changed. I do really think that there genuinely has been some remarkable progress. At the hospital that I was born in, there were segregated maternity wards for white kids and black kids. There really weren't opportunities. So I do think that there has been remarkable progress. But I think that too often those of us who are white kind of focus on this narrative of progress and don't fully acknowledge the degree, you know, how much more there is still to be done. And I think it's that especially we look at the fact that we now have a black president in the White House, and I think for many Americans that just underscores that, everybody now has an equal chance to do anything. And I think the fact that we have a black president is remarkable, but I don't think it proves that our problems are resolved.
Mm-hmm. Well, unless the figure you cited, I can't find it in my notes, of the number of young black men who are killed by police when you compare it with whites who are killed by police, it's quite a difference.
ProPublica did a study showing that young black men were 21 times as likely to be killed by police as young white men. The response from some of my white readers has been, well, that just underscores how violent and criminal many young black men are. But I think that it's more than that. And there's overwhelming evidence that we do carry in our heads, and this is true of blacks as well as whites. I mean, bias affects everybody of every race, that we have these stereotypes in our mind of young black men as dangerous, and they affect how we perceive the world. There was one classic study that it was like a game of telephone, and it started out with describing a knife fight in which a white man with a knife confronted a black man, and by the time it was repeated six times, it was now the black man who held the knife and not the white guy. And then this was done with photos in a British study. It showed images of sketches, not photos, sketches of a white man with a knife confronting a unarmed black man. And people, research subjects, looked at these images. Then I think they waited 45 minutes. Then they were asked questions about what they had seen. And a majority, in one version of this experiment, a majority actually said that what they remembered was that it had been the black guy with the knife. And, you know, so these are really deeply embedded stereotypes. And I think we have the misperception sometimes that the problem of racism is people who believe in inequality, you know, old sort of KKK folks running around with hoods. And that is not the problem. I think the much larger problem is well-meaning people who intellectually believe deeply in racial equality and yet have absorbed these biases, these stereotypes, and this is true of blacks as well as whites. One sociologist calls it a racism without racists. And I think there's some evidence that the same is true of gender, that, you know, the problem is not misogynist. The problem is people, male and female alike, who believe in gender equality, and yet when they get a resume from a woman, they subconsciously don't think it's as good as the same resume coming from a man.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's also something that must be in the minds, subconsciously perhaps, of many people who run school districts all over this country, too, because you can't have a primarily African-American district that's dirt poor, where people are dealing with horrendous problems at home, and not pay attention to it, you know, not realize that that's the great equalizer for all of us. And if you're not going to make your schools equal, if you're not going to make them really top-notch educational experiences, then you're just playing lip service to it. Oh, I believe in equality. You don't if that's the way schools operate.
Yeah, I truly believe that the best escalator out of poverty, whether you're talking about Chicago or Tanzania, is education.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem in both Tanzania and in the U.S. is that those kids who most need that escalator, for them it's broken. And so if you are a white suburban kid in this, you know, who has a lot of middle class support at home, then you get a great school with great teachers. If you are a inner city student of color who isn't getting a lot of support from home, then you may well go to a third rate school with relatively less effective teachers. And that is a profound inequity. One of the things we emphasize in our new book, A Path Appears, is the degree to which early childhood education can, to some degree, mitigate inequality. And I think one reason for both blacks and whites, one reason why anti-poverty efforts haven't been more successful over the last generation is that they start too late. It's a lot easier to help a six-month-old or a six-year-old than it is a 16-year-old. But I guess one of my frustrations is also that we have this narrative, we often hear, a personal responsibility. And, you know, there is indeed something to that. But we as a society also have a responsibility when we have the toolboxes that will provide opportunity, that will make a difference. We have those toolboxes and we don't actually implement them. We don't provide these early childhood interventions. And so kids fall through the cracks. And, you know, we fail those kids.
Let's go to Nick in Minneapolis. Hi, Nick.
Hi. I'm curious as to those startling numbers we heard between the wealth gap between white families and black families, whether that's been looked at when accounting for the 1% of top earners, which presumably increases the average white income but really says nothing to the median white family's income.
Those are actually median figures from the census, so they're not affected by the increase in the mean. But those are median black household net worth versus median white household net worth.
Bob in Milwaukee. Hi, Bob.
Hi, I just wanted to ask that, you know, what about the responsibility of the parents? I mean, both black and white, and, you know, all races, I think that racism starts in the home. You know, because I don't think that they're investing in their communities enough to trust the people in the community. And I think that racism starts in the home. That's my personal belief.
All right, Bob, thank you. Is that where we learn it?
You know, I mean, I think that you're absolutely right that parenting plays a huge role in family structure. And I think that one thing that liberals got, in retrospect, totally wrong over the last 50 years was in underappreciating the importance of a family. And when Daniel Patrick Moynihan came out with his famous study on the black family, there he was criticized in a way that, in retrospect, you know, was absolutely wrong. I think the evidence has accumulated that, for reasons that are somewhat unclear, especially for boys, it's very, very important to have a dad at home. But I think that what conservatives get wrong is, having appreciated the importance of family structure, they embraced a policy of mass incarceration that quintupled incarceration rates since 1970 and broke up vast numbers of homes, disproportionately black homes, because of the way the war on drugs was carried out, and also have been reluctant to provide family planning support so that kids who don't want to get pregnant, you know, can avoid pregnancy. In America right now, about 30% of teenagers become pregnant by age 19. You know, there are things we can do that can indeed help improve family structure, and we don't do them. And there are programs that will support parents and coach parents on things like reading to your kids that we can do that would improve outcomes, and yet we don't do them. So there, you know, it's often said that people often say of those who are poor that, well, you know, stop complaining, stop this victimization narrative, and just, you know, do what you can to make a difference. Well, I think the same is true of us as a society, that we should, that there is a real problem with some parents not investing enough time and effort in their kids. That's, you know, and there are things that we can do about that are under our control, like providing family planning services, like providing these parental coaching programs, like Nurse Family Partnership, which, and indeed, those two efforts would actually save us public money, but they reduce public spending later on. And yet we have failed to do that, and I think that demonstrates a lack of a personal responsibility in all of our parts.
Here's an interesting email. Lionel writes, he's appreciating this discussion, he says, but when you talk about black people and compare blacks to other races who have come to this country, you make blacks, African Americans, sound like underachievers. Look at history and American history, you'll find that blacks have strived and thrived in spite of the very things that you have correctly identified. There are so many African Americans, and I might add, since the beginnings of this country, who have created, innovated, and added so much to the American and world experience, but African Americans are looked at like every one of us has a ghetto mentality. Look at business, education, government, literature, and entertainment, and you can see that African Americans are anything but underachievers.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Very true. I mean, there is what we have now is a class gap, and also a race gap, and the problem is where they converge. So there is a, you know, those at the bottom of the socioeconomic status spectrum where that overlaps with African Americans, then that's where the challenge is. And over time, the race gap has diminished to some degree, and the class gap has widened to some degree. But there, one, I quoted Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative as saying that, you know, when you are both poor and black, it's like having two kinds of cancer at the same time in terms of your, you know, how you interact with society.
Mm-hmm.
It's there, and that's so. I totally agree with the caller, but you know, it's those at the bottom that is, that's where the problem is.
And you look at this number. I read it about three times, Nicholas, and thought, oh my gosh, does this say a lot? Black men in their 20s without a high school diploma are more likely to be incarcerated today than employed. And then you go on to say nearly 70% of middle-aged black men who never graduated from high school have been imprisoned. 70%.
And it's, you know, the toll of that is, of course, much greater than just that time in incarceration. Once you have been imprisoned, you become much less employable. That means you also become much less marriageable. You become mm-hmm. marginalized by your community. And I, you know, I grew up in this farming community in Oregon, and there has been a similar problem with the white working class, and it's men who are not well educated, and then they self-medicate with meth.
Mm.
They get arrested. Once they have a criminal record, they become even less employable
mm-hmm.
and less marriageable, and the result is more kids who grow up without a dad at home, without a father figure, and repeat that cycle. And, you know, these are hard problems. These are, you know, poverty is about more than just lack of income. But I think there are ways we can address this and do more about them. There are some policies that really do make a proven difference. And it is very frustrating when we don't introduce them.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Nicholas Kristof is our guest, Pulitzer Prize winning. He's won it twice, New York Times columnist, and his five-part, I don't know if it's going to go on. I'm sure it will. He's going to write about this issue for a long time, unless everything is solved in the next year, which is probably not going to happen. His series, well worth your attention, When Whites Just Don't Get It. It started first column August 30th, and there's another one that appeared, well, five of them, and today, I mean, yesterday there was one as well. So here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In yesterday's column, you wrote that if you are white, your interactions with police are more likely to have been professional and respectful, and then you're more trustful. If you're black, your encounters leave you dubious and distrustful. That's why Huffington Post poll found 64% of African Americans believe that Officer Wilson should be punished, while only 22% of whites think that. What a gulf that is, and I'm wondering about the response to Ferguson that we've seen all over the country and the response that we've seen today in the White House with the president deciding that he's asking Congress for $263 million to equip local police with body cameras and to add more resources for police training. Your response to both of those, to Ferguson generally and to today's news?
You know, I think that body cameras and indeed, you know, more car cameras, more cameras of every kind, I think there's some evidence that they are useful, frankly, for both sides and by providing documentation and accountability. And so I hope that they will be indeed rolled out and ideally on kind of a research basis so that we can measure the impact that they have on reducing these kinds of confrontations. I think that the militarization of police departments providing some of this mm-hmm. leftover military equipment has also, frankly, among everything else, just been a waste of money. I mean, there are some – you visit small towns that are getting some of this huge hardware from Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's, you know, it looks like sort of boys getting new toys. It's hard to see how in some remote Vermont town what they're going to do with these things except show them off in their July 4th parades. Mm. And in terms of the reaction to policing, you know, it's we just have this problem that we bring to any of these things our own experiences, and the experience of a white person is so different from that of a mm-hmm. African American male in particular. And I think that the only thing we can do is at least acknowledge that gulf, acknowledge that there is a reality that informs that other opinion, and do what we can to talk about it a little more, at least to kind of break the taboo about race that I think impoverishes the country as a whole.
Let's go to Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I think generalizing about any race is part of the issue of not only the policeman you were just referring to, but it makes people generalize about stereotypes that I went to Montgomery, Alabama, when Martin Luther King died, and I saw real racism there. And I'll tell you what, I don't think things have changed much when even having Obama for president. I voted for him a couple of times. He said he was going to get out of Afghanistan. Well, no, he hasn't. He's been bending over for corporate America, and I don't think that a lot of black people are thankful that he's bringing in Hispanic people to compete for jobs. And even white people are upset that we're, you know, possibly middle-of-the-road racists, but now they're full-blown. Take a look at the Republicans.
All right, well, let's, before we take a look at everybody, I still think African-Americans in this country have enormous pride in this president, enormous pride in him.
Yeah, and, you know, it's an interesting point the caller raises about whether talking about racial biases just inflames them, whether we should kind of just try to move beyond it. And I'm skeptical partly because I think of this issue of implicit biases that we're not consciously aware of. The evidence is overwhelming. For example, there are these resume tests where a scholar will send out a resume that has a traditionally African-American name on it, and then the same resume with a name that has a Caucasian-sounding name on it. And the Caucasian names, those resumes get many more callbacks. Likewise, when people are asked to look at a resume that is from John, they think this resume is a more qualified applicant than if it's the same resume with Jane so-and-so on it. And, you know, this is true of women as well as men, of blacks as well as whites. These are deeply embedded. And I think that unless we're conscious of and willing to talk about and face the degree to which we are all part of the problem, and that the problem is not some small minority who is out there actively discriminating and trying to create inequality, but rather a broad society of well-meaning people who are trying to do the right thing but are shaped by their unconscious biases, by the way their minds work, by the stereotypes that they carry. I think that's the only way we're going to actually chip away and create a fairer society. Mm-hmm.
It's still, maybe I'm way off base with this, but I was still astounded when this country elected Barack Hussein Obama. Talk about names on a resume. I mean, you couldn't have anything that sounded a bit more foreign than that name. He's, you know, he's half white and half black, but he was elected president of the United States. And I've lived long enough and lived in the South and you know, seen a lot of racism in my life. And I was just, I was amazed. I was really quite moved by the whole thing.
Yeah, it was a it was a milestone, and then four years later,
right.
I think it. But I think it was a. I mean, I think 4 years later, it was a. It was, you know, I cover a lot of other countries around the world, and it by comparison to see a African American running against a Mormon, that was a fine moment in American democracy.
You're right. Thank you, Jeff, for the call. Sarah in Madison, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to confirm and agree with everything your author is saying. And I'm a white woman married to a black man. We've been married for 33 years. We've raised three kids together. And my experience is that racism is very much alive and well in Wisconsin. And, you know, our police departments are biased. They're not representative of their communities. You know, if we want to get rid of racism, we have to have people in leadership who represent, you know, people of color. You have to have black teachers, you have to have black educators, administrators, you have to have, you know, black police officers. You know, in every way, shape, and form, we have to, you know, break the glass ceiling, so to speak, and we in Wisconsin have not done it. And, you know, I basically walk in two worlds. If I'm alone, I'm treated like a white woman, and when I'm with my family, you know, we're followed, we're harassed, our checks are denied, we're lied to, things are taken from our family, you know. It's bad in Wisconsin. It's bad.
Nicholas.
And I'm curious, do you think that, I mean, do you think that the problem is people who are flat out conscious racists who believe that blacks are inferior, or do you think the problem that many of these people doing these things are, you know, intellectually believe in equality but just are skewed in the way they act?
I believe it's both. I believe that intellectually people are walking around saying there's no way that I'm racist, no way. But if my child is up against a white child and they would prefer to see the white child have it, they're going to give it to the white child even if my child deserves it. And I don't. I think it's a combination of both. And I've seen it with all three of my children. And I'm lying to you about who I am and where I'm from to protect my family. Racism is alive and well in Wisconsin. And you know, it's sad. It breaks my heart. I enjoy your writing. I follow you. It's very, very sad. And what's really sad to me is that in the 80s, when my husband and I fell in love, we had a deep conversation with my father-in-law. He's now deceased. And he begged me not to do it. He said it was going to be very, very difficult, and he loved me. And he said, you know, I just am trying to warn you what you're in for, and I'm trying to warn you what your kids are in for. And this is back in 1981. And I was so naive, you know, I was so naive. I didn't understand. And yet when things are happening to my family day in and day out, I now understand what my father-in-law was trying to warn me about.
And if you were talking to, if you were advising a young woman today who was in love with a black man and she came to you for advice, what would you say?
If you're in love with him, marry him. You know, I don't believe that this is, I don't believe that what happens is God's will. And I believe in God. And I believe that God created us equal. And I don't believe for a moment that God wants what's happening to happen. So I don't regret the decision to marry, and I definitely don't regret the decision to have the children. I wish I had more. But I'm not going to lie to you and deny the difficulty of watching your children be discriminated against day in and day out. It breaks your heart.
And on that note, Nicholas, write another article, please. Don't make it just a five-part series, and I'm sure you won't. Thank you very much for being with us this hour and for all the writing, too. Thank you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. Nicholas Kristof. Our guest this hour, he has written five columns in his New York Times series on When Whites Just Don't Get It. He had one yesterday, and August 30th was the first of this particular series. He is a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. He grew up on a sheep and cherry farm in Oregon, so you never know where you're going to go in your life. He went to Harvard, went to Oxford, studied Arabic and Chinese, has lived on many continents, and has a new book with his wife, and it is A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity, about making a difference here and making a difference abroad. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour. Thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for listening and for your contributions. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 1 until 3. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.